Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, May the 21st, 2017. Of course, you can check out the show all the time at MetsMorizeOnline.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media. And you can check out the show on SoundCloud, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Stitcher, pretty much whatever podcast service you desire. And, that'll be that. Leave me a review on iTunes. That's something big. Like I said, if you could give me some feedback, that's always appreciated. And you guys know me. I'm Mike Silva. I don't think I have to tell you unless you're checking in for the first time. And if so, you go to MikeSilvaMedia.com. You can find out a little bit about me. Got to probably update that website. Now, if you're paying attention, you heard the new intro. And I don't know how it's going to play with you guys, so give me some feedback. I guess Twitter at Mike Silva Media, whether you like it or not. Now, if you're paying attention, though, that is the Meet the Mets song from the 70s. And if you listen to the podcast every week so that you know, there's the organ music that is what I come back, the music bed from commercial, the was it the Jane Jarvis organ music, I guess we could call it. Is that the right thing? Maybe some of the historians could check in on that for me. And then the outro is the Meet the Mets from the 80s, specifically what you probably, if you're around my age, probably started listening to baseball in the 80s and you heard that music bed coming out of Met games probably on WFAN. So if you know that. So I said to myself, okay, I've got the, you know, what is it called, the Let's Go Mets 86, Let's Get Metsmerized song that opening to since I started the podcast last year, which tied into the website, MetsMorizedOnline.com, who is the great sponsor of this show and supporter of this show and who has promoted this show. So I found this, and I was on Twitter, and here's how I found it. I found it at Mets Police, Mets Police, big Mets fan. He's always looking, you know, big-time Mets fan from the 70s. I guess he started watching baseball. Found this on YouTube. I listened to it, and I'm like, that might be a good changeup. I'm not saying I'm going to shelve the original intro. Maybe I'll do something different every week within these two, maybe add another one. But I wanted to try it out. So anyway, you're not here to listen to me talk about my production of the show, but I thought it was something different. I was trying to get the flow listening to it. Okay, when do I jump in? I'll listen back. Was it too loud? I don't know. I'll have to see what you know, got to see, you know, what you guys particularly like, dislike, what I like, what I dislike, and we'll take it from there. Anyway, enough with the intro. Hope you liked it. If you didn't, we'll figure something out. And if I like it and you didn't, I guess I'm the one who really matters, I guess. Anyway, Mike Vaccaro, the New York Post, will be joining me today. I had a chance to catch up with Mike before the Mets took on Anaheim earlier today. I think it's one of the better segments I've had this year. Mike has written two very talk radio-esque debatable columns in the month of May, one regarding retired numbers and who should be retired and who shouldn't. He gets into it with me regarding Mets' specific retired numbers. Obviously, that is topical more because of what the Yankees did last weekend, retiring Derek Jeter's number two. And there's always some criticism of the Yankees. It seems like they retired just about anybody who has any modicum of success in a Yankees uniform. And then you got the Mets, who pretty much don't retire anybody's number unless you walk on water. And I believe when I was part of a roundtable, when I used to get invited, when the Mets weren't really good and they gave a you-know-what about what people, independent media, thought about them, I got invited to a roundtable. Jeff Wilpon was there, believe it or not. At the time, I was told not to tell anybody that Jeff Wilpon was there. We're going on like 5 or 6 years now. I don't think it really matters anymore. And there's some fun stories. I probably shouldn't share most of them about Jeff in that meeting. But anyway, they had talked about how the Mets Hall of Fame committee is just – that's what they want. They want to have a very strict interpretation of retired numbers. And Piazza at the time wasn't even retired. And I guess they pretty much had said if Mike gets the Hall of Fame, we'll retire his number. If he doesn't, we're not. Anyway – Mike Vaccaro has some pretty strong thoughts about that, and he's going to share those with me, or he shared those with me earlier today. We also talk about another column that came out this weekend regarding managers, and he went through each team and went through who is their best manager coach in their history. That's also topical considering that Terry Collins this weekend became the longest tenured manager in Mets history. And if that's not enough history for you in one weekend, Jose Reyes got his 2000th hit, career hit, as not a member of the Mets. Most of them, about 1,700, are as a member of the New York Mets. And if you think about it, Jose Reyes, if he sticks around for a couple more years and plays a little bit, he might go down with the most hits in Mets history. Because when you have the news that came out this weekend that Jose Reyes, that David Wright was shut down from throwing, I think you and I know, and I've been saying this for a long while, I think we've probably never going to see, probably seen the last of David Wright on a baseball field in a playing capacity. I doubt we see him at all, in any capacity at any point in time, unless he wants to coach. So that, that's obviously sad news. And it's pretty much been buried. Nobody's been talking about it at all. But that's what, you'll hear from Mike Vaccaro in a little bit. I had a great sit-down conversation with him. I guess that's what you call it. It was a radio conversation, but a great conversation with him earlier this morning before the Mets took on the Anaheim Angels. And again, it's Sunday, so the Mets get clobbered. What else is new? Every time I come on the air, the Mets seem to get clobbered this year. And, I was thinking about it because you had the week, which was the 0-6 road trip, 7 losses in a row, and you had a couple of really good wins on Friday and Saturday, which fell more into the category of where this team needs to be. And I look at the schedule. So this is a really important week for the Mets, a really important week. Right now, they come into the game. They were 18-23. They lost, so they're 18-24. They're 6 under 500. And if you know any of my credos and rules, and this is a very simple one, and I don't think anybody in the audience could disagree, but I really cannot take a team seriously until they hit 500. You hit 500, then at least that's the bare minimum. That's par. When he's a golf term, that's par for you to be considered a contender. And the Mets going 7 games into 500, they have their work cut out for them. That's almost not quite a month, but that could be about 3 weeks worth of baseball where you take 2 out of 3. At least, and you do it consistently to get to 500. So it is possible that it'll take the Mets until Memorial Day, maybe past Memorial Day, to get to par. And then you'll see what happens. If you look at the schedule this week, You got San Diego for three. You go to Pittsburgh for three. They go to Pittsburgh for three. Then they have Milwaukee for four at Citi Field, and Milwaukee's been playing well. And then Pittsburgh for three at Citi Field. Outside of the three in Milwaukee, and Pittsburgh's not a bad team, so it's not like all of a sudden the Mets are just going to walk all over the Pirates. I think the three against San Diego is really the big one to get three games there, pull within three games under 500, and then you could peck away over the next two or three series by winning those series or at least splitting with Milwaukee and then taking two out of three. You know, it's going to probably be, you're looking at the first week of June. By the time June 6th rolls around, the Mets go to Texas and then Atlanta, you want them to be just about 500. Because if they're still 4-5 under at that point, they play lousy, you're going to start to wonder if this is happening, if this is going to get better. Now, here's where the optimism could play. And I'm amazed as I look at these numbers. Right now, and this is so frustrating, because if you told me in spring training that the Mets on May 21st would be averaging 5, and look at it on Baseball Reference, coming into today's ballgame, and that didn't change because the Mets scored exactly 5 runs today, that the Mets would be averaging 5 runs a game, I would say, wow, they're in good shape. They're probably leading, if not the National League East, they probably are leading the entire National League in wins because their pitching is too good. I mean, they don't need to score 5. Last year, they were barely scoring 3.5-4 a game, and they struggled, but they were able to win 87 ball games. And that's not the case. You know why? Because you go down to the pitching, they are last, dead last. And, you know, this is runs per game, giving up runs, not ERA. They're giving up 5.49 runs a game. Now, you know, and I'll do the math real quick. They have given up 225 runs, and they've played before today's game. They played, and that didn't get better today, guys. They gave up 12 runs today. 12 runs today. So in 225 runs in 41 games coming into today's action, take away the 23-run game. That is basically 202 going into 41. How much is the impact? I mean, even if you take out the Mets' disastrous 23-run game against the Nats, they're a little under 5 runs per game, which puts them right about where the Nationals are. The Nationals' pitching hasn't been good. So, you know, it's interesting. You take that one game, swung it one way or the other. The good news is this. I think the schedule right now is favorable for them, and I think even without Syndergaard, without Familia, I don't know when Cespedes, I'm assuming he's going to pop in eventually in the next 10 days, you would hope, maybe by the end of the month. And they've survived Cespedes not being in the lineup. It hasn't affected the lineup. There was a stat on the SNY broadcast that they are second in the National League in runs scored in May. I believe it was the National League. They've been fine offensively. The pitching has the tools to get better. That's the point. You look at the Mets pitching, you don't see a team that doesn't have something to work with. Yes, Mats and Lugo are probably coming back. I'm going to be a little less bullish on Lugo because he has that partial tear. I know pitchers have pitched through that. The one guy across town has been pitching through it for a couple of years, and until recently when he's getting clobbered, he's actually done pretty well. Wheeler has been positively good when you've looked at him. He's given you some good outings. I'm surprised. DeGrom seems to be coming around. He was gritty. I would have pulled him. I think Terry played with fire. It was the seventh inning. He was way off when he had the cut on his, or the blister on his ring finger, I believe it was. I'm not one to go gaga over Harvey's outing, but I still anticipate him getting better. I think Gesellman has to get better. He's shown a little bit more improvement out of the bullpen. I know the bullpen's been bad recently, but I still really believe that it's not a bad bullpen. That it, and I like Sewald. I think keep an eye on him. He's a keeper. May not throw hard, but he's got movement, and he seems to be able to go after hitters. He doesn't walk a lot of guys. In 12 innings, he only walked 2 batters. I like that. So, yeah, you're going to get the Montero clunkers. You're going to get the Tommy Malone clunkers. You got some, you know, Hansel Robles stinks. I've been saying that for a while. But I still think you have enough to navigate from now until the All-Star break to get this where then you could evaluate and say, you know, what do I add in the bullpen? Is the offense good enough? I think that's where you're going to want to add is the bullpen. And you may have to add a starting pitcher if there's somebody there. I don't know if that's a realistic ask because you don't know when and if Syndergaard's going to come back. I wouldn't rely on Familia. Basically, you want to add some veteran depth to that rotation. And is there a swingman type that you could put in there? Because if Syndergaard comes back, do you move Gazelman to the bullpen? See, if you get the veteran, it gives you some options. And then there's the story today about Wheeler and innings limits and what could happen there. There's so many questions. But the bottom line is I think there is at least the benchmark where I could turn around and say, hey, that could get better. That 5 runs a game or whatever it is, what I just gave you, over 5, almost 5.5 runs a game, that's probably closer to 6 after today. That's going to get better. Will the 5 runs a game on the offense continue and be sustainable? Maybe not quite because there's still, I think, peaks and valleys. But it's not a crazy overplay. It's not an over-index where you're like, oh, well, this offense can't do this. They're doing it without Cespedes. And Conforto, to me, is here to stay. He's not screwed up anymore. It's not like you're looking at Conforto and say, well, he's playing over his head. You haven't got anything out of Granderson. Bruce, I think, has been historically Jay Bruce. It's not like he's gone crazy. He's dropped off a little bit in the last week or so. You really haven't got a lot out of first base. You haven't got a lot out of third base. Shortstop's been up and down. Neil Walker just started hitting. Behind the plate, maybe Rene Rivera's over-indexed a little bit, but you figured Darno will come and do a little bit more offensively. So I don't think there's nothing around the offense, around the field, that tells you that this is a crazy overplay on offense. And there's nothing on the staff that I think tells you that the talent isn't there to do better. Unless Matt Harvey is going to play at a 75 ERA plus, which is 25% below league average. Basically, most guys at AAA could do better than Matt Harvey right now, which you and I know is not true. Adam Wilk showed you that, because Adam Wilk is supposed to be that 4A guy, that the 100 ERA plus is the baseline. So there's your positives. Schedule, that's going to allow you some time to figure this out and get back to par. The offense is doing what you expected, what it didn't do last year until maybe late August. And the pitching, which has been a mess, has to get better. So when you look at it that way, there's hope. And you saw some positive signs Friday and Saturday. Are the Angels a juggernaut? No, but they have Mike Trout in the lineup. I mean, you saw what Trout can do. They're not chopped liver. They got some veteran bats. They got some guys like Simmons who kills the Mets all the time. So on this Sunday, where the Mets get clocked again, make you wonder if, like I said last week, it's going to be worth investing in this team. There is, I'm telling you, maybe still a reason for hope, but it's got to turn around soon, and they got to have a good two-week span here. If they're still seriously floundering going into that Texas-Atlanta road trip, that's starting to get kind of late to be under 500, in my opinion. Yeah, I know they were 16-62 last year. But I also don't know. You got to assume that the wild card is going to play at about 90 games, 90 wins. And 90 and 72, which is, what were they? That was what they were the year they went to the World Series. You can't be 10 games under or 8 games under too late into June, early July, and expect to all of a sudden go on that monster run. They went on a 27-13 run. I believe it was about 27-13 in August last year. That's playing seriously good. That's like one of the top five in all baseball type play at that point. And, you just can't expect to do that. You can't sit back and wait for August every year. That's not – I know that that's what they keep talking about, but you got to start it now. And that's really where you're at here with this New York Mets club. So – I'm going to take a quick break. When I return, you'll hear from Mike Vaccaro. We get into retired numbers, who should be retired, who shouldn't. We get into managers and all sorts of great debate. We talk about Terry Collins, who became the longest tenured Mets manager. And I really, Mike is one of my favorites. The New York Post is such strong columnist that They're the ones who I tend to go to a lot of times here on this broadcast. So Mike Vaccaro, who's it's been a long time. I think it was probably May of last year, the last time I had him on. But had him on, and we talked about a lot of stuff, and we'll get to it. So anyway, you're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check out the show all the time at MetsMorizedOnline.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media. And if you can, go to iTunes, subscribe to the show, leave a comment, leave a review. It is greatly appreciated. We'll be back with Mike Vaccaro right after this.
Hey, Mets fans. I'm going to let you in on a little secret. If you're looking for the best unbiased and independent coverage of the New York Mets, then look no further than MetsMorizedOnline.com. Mesmerized Online is the go-to place for comprehensive Mets coverage, including exclusive interviews, daily original articles, great weekly features, in-depth analysis, minor league reports, game-by-game breakdowns, and so much more. Find out why thousands of fans turn to Mesmerized Online every day to get the latest news and opinions about the Mets. Coming from an impressive staff of the most passionate fans and skilled writers ever assembled, all in one place. Check it out for yourselves, Mets fans. Go to MetsMorizedOnline.com right now. That's Mets, M-E-R-I-Z-E-D, online.com, and get Metsmerized today.
We're back. And joining us from the New York Post, Mike Vaccaro. It's been a while since we've talked to Mike. You guys all know him on Twitter at Mike Vac. Mike, Mike Silva, how are you today? What's going on?
Mike, I'm doing well. How are you doing this morning?
I can't complain. Now, there were rumors. Were you indeed watching the Mets as a spectator yesterday at Citi Field? Did I happen to see a picture of you actually putting yourself through that as a media member, as a spectator at a baseball game? A busman's holiday, right?
I have to admit that the seats were so good that that no pity is required. It was a very fun night. My high school buddies are all Mets fans, poor guys, and so we had a nice little miniature reunion last night at Citi Field. It was almost completely ruined there at the end.
Yeah, that was for sure fun, and a lot going on in New York sports, and you've had a couple of very interesting columns. One this morning we'll get to in a minute, and I guess leading up to the Derek Jeter number retirement ceremony, you wrote a little while back, earlier in the month, about New York numbers deserve to be retired. And it's interesting because I heard Bill Madden on the radio last week, and even he, who's covered the Yankees for a million years, said maybe the Yankees are a little too liberal with the way they retire numbers. And a lot of Yankees fans I've spoken to agree. The Mets, on the other hand, are, I guess on the other end of the spectrum. Where do you fall? Before I get to kind of, who should be a retired number, who shouldn't be, where do you fall on that?
I guess I'm somewhere in the middle. I mean, to me, there's a couple of ways that you get your number retired. One is if you're, one of the best players ever played, which, so the Yankees certainly have enough room for guys like Mantle and Gehrig and Bruce and DiMaggio. I mean, there's certainly – eight or nine numbers that are no-brainers for the Yankees because of their rich history. And for the Mets, Piazza would probably qualify. Tom Seaver certainly qualifies. The other way is if you're an iconic, specific to your franchise. Am I iconic? You kind of grade that on a scale, right? Because, certainly in 1978, Ron Guidry was iconic to the Yankees. But, over the long course of his career, does 49 deserve to be on the same place on the wall as, say, 7 or 2 or 3. I mean, what's fun about it is you can debate it all day. But it's certainly under those terms that I would say that somebody like Keith Hernandez belongs, with his 17 retired at Citi Field. Certainly, that's going to be the argument that is going to be made by a lot of people, probably including ownership, when they put David Wright's number on the wall, right? Because David Wright basically is going to, if you assume that, no assumptions are probably required yet, but I would think David Wright's number 5 is going to go on the wall at some point. He's probably not going to be the guy who leads them to a World Series the way Hernandez did, but he's going to obviously be an iconic member of the franchise, all but certainly will have played all of his career with the Mets and a very good career. I don't think anybody there are people who would argue that because of what the Mets have used as their standard, that Wright doesn't belong either, but I would think that a wall in 20 years, it doesn't include number 5 would be, missing something. But I think it's missing something now, without 17 or 8. So
that's, you know, really interesting. Get a lot of meat in there. Wright's interesting. Before I get to the Carter Hernandez, which I agree with, and unfortunately Carter's not around anymore to enjoy a celebration if they decide to do that, was that Wright, not that the fans dislike him, but he might be the one that would go down as leaving the fans wanting. Even, I mean, Strawberry and Gooden would fall into that, but there was still a lot there. For whatever reason, if you polled a bunch of Mets fans, would Wright feel like, and I agree with you, you know, the guy's been with the Mets his entire career, leads in every offensive category, had some great years early on, but because what has transpired the last 5 years, even more going back to when Citi Field opened, you might get a different response from Mets fans where they just don't feel it, which is that little, you know, thing that we don't really we can't explain statistically, but yeah, just something to think about.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and you know, it's funny because I wrote a fairly long David Wright piece a few weeks ago, and you know, even someone like me who's covered, you know, the Mets pretty extensively for the entirety of his career, you kind of forget how good he was, which is really kind of amazing, right? Because usually, you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder, and you start to, you know, I think in most people's case or players' case, that when they go, you know, when you spend all this time away from the game as Wright has, you know, I think people tend to overestimate how good you are. And I think it's the opposite with the Mets fans and Wright. I think I know it was with me. You forget, you know, just how good he was in 06, 07, 08, even, you know, 2000. Even when the season started to turn, you know, he had some pretty solid years, and you forget about that, just how good he was. And that's, you know, it's a very interesting and unique thing to David Wright, I think. Because, like I said, usually when you wind up spending time outside the game, you know, people tend to overestimate how good you were.
Very true. And his counterpart that came up about the same time, Jose Reyes, got his 2,000th hit last night. And that's not chopped liver. Look, it's not Derek Jeter. But if you start ranking him, and I haven't done that, but if you start ranking him among shortstops or those who play shortstops a large percentage of their career, that's not chopped liver for the position, Mike, at all. You know, we kind of forget about that.
You do. I have to admit that, you know, that I saw that on the scoreboard yesterday. And I guess you can't say you're stunned because, you know, he's been around a long time and he's had some good years. And so what happens is you compile numbers. But I guess, you know, in my mind, even though, you know, especially when you watch him, you know he's not 23 anymore. I think in a lot of ways he's frozen in time as being 23, 24 years old and, you know, the fastest guy in the sport and most exciting player in New York, blah, blah, blah. And you kind of forget that he had a lot of years where he collected a lot of hits, you know, and that's a substantial milestone, you know. I mean, I don't think anybody's going to delude ourselves into thinking that we're going to have a conversation about Jose Reyes being a Hall of Famer or, for that matter, even if his number 7 will ever go on the wall at Citi Field. But he's had a very good career, and, you know, some of that has been colored by the fact that he had the off-field problems, and, you know, that should be a factor, I think, in the way that we, you know, view the sum total of Jose Reyes' public, you know, professional life. But he really has had a very good career. It's encouraging to people like me, I think. I mean, as a baseball player, I've always had a real soft spot for him because I just thought that he came as close as anybody the Mets have ever had to really channeling what's kind of a National League treasure for New York, which is Jackie Robinson, as a player, obviously. You know, we're not going to talk about anything correlating the two of them for what they went through, you know, personally on the way up. But as players, you know, and I never saw Jackie Robinson, obviously, but you see film and you hear stories. And, you know, even last night, you know, it's funny. It was hard not to think about that. You know, a couple of times he's on third base and he's doing that thing that he always did back in the day where he's, you know, charging a third of the way down the line, trying to get in the pitcher's heads. And I think we all remember, you know, that actually worked against Armando Benitez one right. day, probably in 06, 07. So, and that's the kind of thing that, you know, at least on film, you know, you see Jackie Robinson do all the time. And so that's to me, you know, Jose Reyes is always the guy I thought that was a modern day tribute to Jackie Robinson, certainly in his heyday, maybe not so much anymore, but it is encouraging to at least see him over the Mendoza line now that, you know, his struggles, which have lasted almost 2 full months, I'm not going to say they're over, but he certainly seems to be on an upswing. And, you know, look, for the overall greater good of the Mets, I mean, certainly they're a better team if Jose Reyes is playing well. So, I think you see the way he's played the last couple of days, and you see the fact that, it is a great reminder when you see on the scoreboard that his 2,000th hit, just how good a baseball player this guy has been for, you know, the better part of 15 years.
For sure. I'm with me, Mike Vaccaro of the New York Post. You bring up off the field and character, and that's where Strawberry and Gooden, which is very interesting. even though, again, talk about leaving fans wanting, they certainly did. That was certainly, you know, a period where there was some very solid numbers. You know, when they 1990, when if they put Strawberry and Gooden at that point, I know Gooden was there longer, but if you stopped right there, you still had a Hall of Fame conversation, and they already had had some problems. It's how will that be viewed as time goes on, as they continue to do, and Doc is trying to, looks like, clean up his life. Strawberry, at least from a public persona, has cleaned up his life, doing some good things. I wonder how that plays in eventually at some point getting honored. Probably not on the wall, but it isn't something that should be totally discounted.
You know, Mike, it's a great point. And look, I mean, there are you know, stratus or tests, if you will, to how the Yankees, you know, honor their players. Some guys get retired numbers, some guys get plaques, some guys get statues, right? I mean, so I'm not saying there has to be a uniform way to do this for teams all across professional sports, but I think that what is glaring right now is that there is no representation for the greatest team in franchise history. Now, part of that, I suppose, can be, you can say, is a tribute to that team, the 86 Mets, who are, you know, very much the product of the sum of their parts. Okay, that's fine. But there should be somebody, some representation on the wall. It's never going to be the manager, probably, because, you know, number 5 doesn't belong to David Johnson anymore, better or worse. So that number is David Wright's, and that's just never going to happen. I understand to a degree why the Mets would be reluctant to have a full-blown ceremony for 16 or for 18, just because of the off-field problems they had. And the fact is, you know, speaking very frankly, the Mets probably would have been talked about in a whole different light, whole different realm, if Strawberry and Gooden specifically had kept their careers on track and their lives on track. I mean, you know, there is a sense of underachievement when you talk about those Mets teams of the 80s, because they only won one championship and only played in one World Series. And only finished first twice, you know, when they were the best team in baseball for probably 5 or 6 straight years. So I understand that, and the prime culprit for that is what happened off the field with their two, you know, most potentially, you know, explosive players. That said, it doesn't explain 17. You know, that's why I think 17 is such a great number retirement, because it's not only honoring Keith Hernandez, who I believe deserves to be honored, because I believe that the acquisition of him was a tipping point in franchise history, even more so than, say, Piazza or, you know, the rise of the recent Mets, because, you know, 1983, there were a lot of people, myself included, who thought the Mets were irreversibly on their way out. And I mean, like, out to where they had already become irrelevant, and who would even notice if they had left town? And one acquisition in 1983, Keith Hernandez, turned the tide, you know, really permanently. And I think that needs to be recognized somehow. I really do. And I think he really is the key to that. And so if nothing else, I think 17 would represent that era of team history, which I think needs to be represented. It's a glaring omission on that wall that you have, you know, the 1962 Mets represented by Casey. And, I can go, you know, a couple hours on whether that's, you know, legitimate retirement. And certainly the 69 Mets are represented by Seaver and by Gil Hodges, and both are, you know, rightfully so. And you have kind of like the modern Mets represented by Mike Piazza. But I just think that in terms of the context of their history, the notion that 86 is completely overlooked, really, you know, in any substantial way in the ballpark, it's crazy. I know people go nuts that there's no Tom Seaver statue, but there is a Tom Seaver entrance where there's a Tom Seaver bust. There's a Gil Hodges bust. You know, there's so very little representation for the signature team in team history. And as you can see, it's something that I think about a lot. I mean, it just that bothers me. That's a team that probably for me is a personal thing, because, you know, I was 19 in 1986. So, I mean, you know, probably your prime baseball caring years are between 14 and 20 before you get out of the real world, while you're kind of figuring things out. And so, as a result, that I find that irksome that there's no official representation of that team anywhere that's, you know, substantial in that ballpark. And I think the best way to do that would be to retire 17.
And he's almost become the Mets version of Phil Rizzuto now in the booth. You know, with this booth work, and we're going on over 10 years now, which is amazing, because I remember SNY and Keith getting in the booth like just when it started. You have a much larger resume. It's not just, well, this guy played for the Mets from 83 to 89, and I think after mid-year 88, 89 was a wash for him. So it was just, he was a Cardinal from a – if Hernandez ever was to go in Hall of Fame, I think he'd have to put him in as a Cardinal. Right.
Absolutely. He won an MVP as a Cardinal. So, I mean, yes, absolutely.
Right.
I agree.
But now he's got the broadcasting thing going on. I personally enjoy him. I know he's gotten himself in hot water a couple times. I mean, you probably would have a Keith Hernandez day, and he wouldn't want to show up. He'd Skype it in from Sag Harbor.
From Sag Harbor, right.
But I think it changes it. And look, another – I don't know how long Hernandez wants to do this, and it doesn't sound like he wants to stop. You know, he becomes a different type of Met because now one generation looks at him in one way, another generation looks at him in another way. And guys like you and I, you're a little bit older than I. I mean, I remember Hernandez more 86 and after. You probably see a little bit more of him when he first came over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a whole generation of Mets fans that see a guy in two different ways. That to me, that could go down as, at least from an anecdotal standpoint, as somewhat of an iconic player.
Me a couple of great points there, Mike. You know, you likened him to the Mets version of Rizzuto. And it's funny because Phil Rizzuto, who was a very good player, would never have come close to Cooperstown, and some would argue still doesn't deserve to be there. That's a whole different conversation. But he never would have come close to even people talking about him getting to Cooperstown, and probably would never have had his number retired, at least not, you know, when it happened, you know, at a time when he was still young enough to enjoy it, had he not been a broadcaster. It was the second half of his tenure as a Yankee that really kind of made him beloved. I mean, you know, and I think that really helped his stature both within baseball, but even more so within the Yankee community. And I think that that's a great point to make about Keith. I've always said, for instance, with Gil Hodges, when it comes to the Cooperstown Hall of Fame, that, okay, if you want to argue that he wasn't a completely Hall of Fame baseball player, even though when he retired, he had the most home runs in the National League for right-handers in history, which is an amazing thing people don't realize. And you certainly can make a case for him as a baseball player, but you can also make a strong case that he's just short. That's fine. He's not, you know, with his teammates Duke Snider and Jackie Robinson and, you know, on that one. Okay, that's fine. And you can say that he wasn't a historically great manager, sadly, because he didn't have a chance to manage more than 5 years. So you can say that individually both those things, you know, maybe if you're judging one or the other, he falls short. But when you combine the two of them, to me, it's an absolute no-brainer that this guy belongs in the Hall of Fame, a core member of the Boys of Summer, who also managed the 69 Miracle Mets. That's a Hall of Fame life. And so to me, when you combine the two of them, he belongs. In the same way, I suppose you could argue that Hernandez, you know, is his time in the Mets is more celebrated than the years, you know, total years would indicate. You can argue that he was mostly a Cardinal. You can argue that maybe in retrospect, he wasn't as great when you look at his numbers, as maybe you thought in the context of time. All I know is that the 1984 season was the most important one for the Mets because it ended 7 years of losing, and suddenly you looked at this team in a whole different way, and Keith Hernandez finished second in the MVP vote that year. It's amazing to think how different things might have been if Ryan Sandberg had, like, sprained an ankle in May that year. And Hernandez, you know, not only would have won the MVP, but the Mets probably would have won the East. That could have changed things a lot in the way that he's perceived. But I absolutely believe that when you combine what he meant to the Mets as a player, what he produces a player, and what he is now as kind of the voice and conscience of the team, to me, it's a no-brainer. I mean, I every year I make a point of trying to, somewhere in my column, say, where is 17? To me, the two glaring omissions in all of New York sports, Mike, you know, are Keith Hernandez 17 at Citi Field and Bernard King's number 30 at the Garden. And I'm so passionate in terms of both of those outlooks that I have a hard time understanding the con argument for both. But even in those two, 17 to me is more the puzzling no-brainer than the number 30.
That's some great points. I have Mike Vaccaro with me of the New York Post. So the weekend that Terry Collins becomes the longest tenured Mets manager, you write a very interesting piece about the best coaches, managers in New York for each individual team. And, you know, if you haven't read it, if the fans haven't read it, no, Terry Collins is not going to be named. Although, I'll tell you what, man, just to get
you would have
into
canceled
that,
my appearance. You would have canceled my appearance if I put Terry Collins number one.
No, I would have loved to have you on. And look, here's the thing. I've met Terry a couple times. You know, he's a good guy. I don't like the way he manages the bullpen. I feel like I just think that exactly, and your colleague Steve Serby wrote a great piece about him today. He was supposed to be caretaker, and he's hung around a lot longer, and he's got some good qualities.
Yeah,
the interesting thing is
he's a very frustrating guy for people to watch day to day. I know this not only because of monitoring the way people talk, fans talk, but just watching him. I mean, it is sometimes a maddening thing to watch day to day. There's no question about that.
And here's the thing, because when I look at your column, as a fan that started really watching sports at 9, 10 years old, which is like 86, 87, you don't really understand sports until you get much older. Like you said, 14 to 20 is when you start to develop maybe a little bit more of a mature sports opinion or knowledge of it. And now with the internet, geez, these kids, I hate to sound like a little fart here, they're much more savvy at, like, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old. Like, Pat Riley's my guy. Like, everybody else falls below that. Like, if you don't fall, and it doesn't matter what sport, Pat Riley's my guy. But that's me. So it's hard for me to wrap my head around.
And it's Bobby your total wheelhouse time as a fan, right? Sure.
Right. Bobby Valentine's another one because I respected a lot. I know he was different, but I respected a lot of what he did with that group. So when I see guys like Collins and to a certain degree Joe Girardi have the longevity, and I look at them like that's not what I think should be the guy that lasts forever. Riley didn't last long enough. I felt Valentine could have, you know, lasted a couple more years. But anyway, I digress. It was very interesting. You put Gil Hodges as the best manager in Mets history, and even with the Giants, football Giants, you put Coughlin ahead of Parcells. So yeah, talk about that. I mean, not just from a Met baseball perspective. You got into a lot, and it's a hard thing because there's managers that back in the 20s, you know, Stengel, McCarthy, you never saw them, McGraw, so on and so forth.
Right. You know, Mike, to be honest, these are the most fun columns I do in the sense that I know when I write them that they're going to be essentially, you know, interactive conversations, thankfully with Twitter, with Facebook, with email. My readers are not bashful about interacting. And what's good is that as I've done more and more of these kind of columns, I think people understand it's not church. I'm not trying to say, it's with the Giants. Like, I mean, I understood from the moment I wrote it, and I won't deny that part of the reason, you know, the tie-breaking vote for me, I voted for Tom Coughlin over Bill Parcells, is because I knew that people would say, what? And what's interesting is that more people than I thought have actually called and agreed with it. But it's the kind of thing that but it's sports. It's not right. It's not wrong. I mean, the world is not going to end or extend because of what your choice is, whether it's Coughlin or Parcells. It's a fun barroom sports conversation, which really is what all this stuff should really be. I mean, look, I mean, we can rip the manager of any team or the coach of any team. It doesn't mean that we want them dead. It just means that we like our teams. And I think I'm grateful that I think the more I've written these columns, more people understand that it's designed to be fun, have a conversation. So that said, so for instance, even with the Mets, you know, and it's funny, I have a friend who's probably your age, you know, I'm going to say probably, you know, 8, 9, 10 years younger than I am. And you know, all he knows about, that makes you exactly 10 years younger than me. So, you know, for you and for him, I mean, you know, all Gil Hodges is a name in a history book. And so you saw and you lived through Bobby Valentine. And, you know, again, as we talked about, you know, certain things, you know, if the Mets only could have won that 2000 World Series so much, that's just not the franchise, but the way that Bobby Valentine is viewed would be so different. And I think that's fair because I think Valentine absolutely belongs to be considered because he, you know, the job he did with the 2000 Mets to me remains one of the most remarkable managing jobs anybody's ever done anytime, anywhere. Benny Agbayani was a starting outfielder in the World Series, for God's sake. Those things are, you know, those things are eternal debates. And I love that. I love that about sports, and I love being able to talk about stuff like that. You know, with the Mets, to me, I think Gil Hodges because for the same reason I told you that I think that him managing the 69 Mets puts him over the top as a Hall of Famer. To me, I mean, I think that's a singular historic accomplishment, you know, in sports that is unparalleled because there just isn't a real professional sports parallel to the 69 Mets. And Gil Hodges, you know, if you talk to any of the players who played for him, was singularly responsible for them doing that. So that's how come to me. I mean, and I'm probably intractable about it. I mean, Terry Collins or the next Mets manager could come in and win 3 championships in 5 years. I'd probably still pick Gil Hodges for that reason. And you know, but I think that's a great argument can certainly be made for Davey Johnson, who never had a bad team. And certainly for Valentine, who took, you know, he took over Dreck from Dallas Green and led them to the World Series 3 years later, which is, you know, in itself a remarkable achievement. So,
but and that's very important. That's very important because if you go back to the climate of New York sports, I mean, the Yankees in 96 and then 97, the Mets coming back, I mean, I don't want to say it's the golden age of baseball, but there was a feel about this town in baseball from 97 to about 2001, 2002. I've never really felt it. When you combine Mets-Yankees since, Yeah, you had 06 and the 15 World Series run, but I'm talking about both teams, both fan bases at the same time. The Knicks and basketball and even the NFL were behind. It was a basketball town, in my opinion, for the most part. Now, that's maybe part of my problem. I've never felt like that Mets-Yankees thing has ever been the same since 2001, since Gonzalez's ball went over Jeter's head and after that 9/11 thing. It's just different now. Maybe it will never be the same, and maybe that's because the Mets were so bad and the Yankees had not won in so long that for the first time maybe ever you had both teams competing against each other. And in theory, I mean, the Mets were competing for a championship, even the Yankees probably had a more likely chance for a championship at the same time.
Yeah, it's a great point, Mike, because you can never replicate the first time, right? So, I mean, the Mets and the Yankees shared this town for years, for decades, and were quote-unquote rivals only in the sense that they both shared the town name. And they never played each other except for the Mayor's Trophy game and maybe one or two games in spring training, but no one cared about that. They were never good at the same time, right? I mean, when you look back between 62 and 1998, they almost never had winning records in the same season. Certainly were never, you know, close to winning a pennant with very rare exceptions. 85, both teams, the Yankees won 97, the Mets won 98, and they were both went to the final weekend of the season before they were eliminated. But that didn't happen. I mean, they didn't both get there. And 85, for me, was the year that I always look back in over the next 10 or 12 years, like, gee, I wonder if we'll ever get like this in New York. That would be cool. And then it did, you know. And yes, I don't think in that era the Mets ever quite approached the Yankees because the Yankees had just become such a phenomenon. But it became a pretty loud town. I mean, you know, it's suddenly looking up and 6 and 7 million people are going to the two ballparks. And it's organic. It's done because both teams are playing well. And to me, I mean, you know, I know I've fed the debate probably in my time about, you know, which is near Yankees town, Mets town. I mean, to me, it's a baseball town. And the fact is, that's what's cool about it, is the fact that you earn it here, you know? I mean, people don't just go to Yankee Stadium blindly because of the Yankees. I mean, you can look at their attendance. And certainly we've discovered that with the Mets. I mean, when the Mets are good, you know, the town becomes rabid. When they're not, it's, you know, it's a ghost town out in Flushing. So, and I think that's great. And the fact is that, you know, 99, 2000, and even in 2001 when the Mets kind of made their run in September after 9/11, I mean, it was a baseball town defined entirely by the success and the uniqueness of getting what, like, our fathers and grandfathers had years and decades ago with the Giants and the Dodgers and the Yankees. We finally got that. And it's never going to be the same the second time around. It's just not, you know. I mean, the Mets can recover this year and the Yankees can maintain and they can both make the playoffs, but it's just not going to be the same, you know, for us, for guys of our generation. You know, maybe it'll be different for kids who are 12, 13 years old experiencing for the first time, and that's pretty cool for them. But it's, you know, you can't ever really replicate that feeling, you know, of the first time. And I can promise you, it was never more fun to write about baseball in this town than it was in 1999 or 2000. Those 2 years, you could go to either ballpark at any day of the week, on a Tuesday afternoon or a Sunday night, and you were going to have something to write about and something to talk about. And it's just going to be, you know, it's hard to replicate that when it's already happened.
That's for sure. And nothing, and I don't know if you were covering that series as a journalist, but that 97 series, and I was watching, I think over the winter, they had put the Malicki game on SNY,
right.
And I was watching it. And I'll tell you what, there's very, you know, there's certain ball games. And as you say, as you get older and life gets more complicated, it becomes less important. But there's certain ball games you could remember details and remember what you were thinking, what you were eating. And that was one of those, because as a Mets fan watching that, it was your chance to for the media, for the Yankee fan base, for the city, to take you seriously, because they still weren't being taken seriously, even though it had a nice little start on the Valentine. And that series at Yankee Stadium, I even though there was fun times, 98, 99, 2000, that one always has a different feel. And it's hard for me to explain here on the air and for those who weren't there watching it, but it just had a different feel. It was unique.
Yeah,
it was new. It was like, wow, this is a World Series, right? In some ways, it felt like a World Series.
You know what's funny, Mike, and I can give you a short personal anecdote about that, is I was actually out of town for a year. I was working at the Kansas City Star. That was my first big newspaper break. So I wasn't there for that. And I remember watching it at a bar in downtown Kansas City, watching that first game, the Malicki game. And, you know, as a guy who grew up just completely covered in New York baseball history, Subway Series, Yankees, Mets, Yankees, you know, Dodgers, Giants, all that stuff. And I just remember saying to myself, all right, it was almost like an epiphany. Like, I always kind of in my mind said, yeah, I really want to get back to New York, and I definitely want that to be my career goal. But I can remember specifically watching that game and thinking to myself, man, I'd love to be there. I'd love to be writing about this. This is what it's about, you know. And to mention the Yankees are finally playing, I got to get back to New York. And, you know, a year later I was. I mean, now I'm not saying it was that game that got me back to New York, but I very distinctly remember saying to myself, I want to be a part of this, you know, whatever my small part can be. And, you know, I'm not, you know, and a member of the media, you know, what we do is chronicle it. You know, and maybe that's not as important as actually, you know, crafting the history yourself the way the players do, but it's fun to be a part of. And I can very distinctly remember watching that Malecki game and saying, man, I want to be a part of that. That's what I want to do.
And if anybody was watching the Calipari 30 for 30, you got a little love there. 2 years later, you go from Kansas City to chasing a narcissistic head coach down in New York. And it plays into my next point, but it must be pretty cool. It must be pretty cool for you to be sitting there. I don't know if you realized that they were going to put your column up in that documentary, but to see your byline there, that's got to be pretty cool.
I won't lie. Yeah, I mean, look, we all have you know, some people look at the word ego in a bad way, and certainly it can be a bad thing when your ego rages out of control. But when you see something like that, I mean, look, I mean, I'm not going to call my friends and relatives and say, hey, turn on ESPN. But certainly when I see it, you know, my wife was sitting there and she was like, wow, that's pretty neat. You know, it's like, wait, look who's there. And you know, there were a couple of friends of mine who were watching. And so I heard from every one of them who saw that, which is kind of, look, I mean, it's cool. Look, you're not a bashful guy, Mike. I'm not a bashful guy. We're going to give our opinions. We're going to get, you know, especially sports. What's great about sports, you know, and I feel bad for like the political columnists who, in most years, are allowed to at least once in a while, you know, have a, you know, throw a softball at the readers and just kind of have fun with it. There's no such thing as writing a fun political column in this climate, no matter what side of the aisle you sit on, right? So. The great thing about sports is that you do get these reminders every now and again that it's fun. It's okay to have fun. Like I said earlier, it's not church. It's just games. And when you guys like you and I are fortunate enough to be able to have our opinions heard by people, it really is fun. And it feeds what I would say is it feeds the good part of your ego, the part that makes you want to write tomorrow's column or do next week's show.
Right. Last thing, you know, ties into the manager thing. You know, and brought up Calipari. You know, you've been doing this a long time. Managers, coaches, even, you know, coordinators here, they're always on the hot seat. It's changed a lot. And, look, one of the things that a lot of fans, and they're on the outside looking in, are like, you know, I think Terry Collins has had pretty fair coverage compared
Absolutely.
To some
no,
others.
No,
I mean,
no
Van
question.
Gundy,
I would agree with that.
Maybe Riley was the only one that I think was always hands-off. And I think Riley would have chopped anyone's head off that criticized them. But even he's a guy that sat Rolando Blackman in the finals, and there was slight criticism, but Terry lived a charmed life. And I was thinking about this before you and I got on the air today, almost because he's taken on the column, and it was while I was reading Serby's column, this survivor, I wasn't supposed to be here moniker.
Yep.
I think there's a sympathy from the media, because naturally media fans go towards a survivor in sports where talent and good grace usually gives you a lot of rewards. I wonder if that's what's played into it. I'm not saying that they're completely soft on him, because I don't want to, like, you know, be unfair here, but I don't think he gets hammered like other Mets managers or other coaches in this town have in the past, even the successful ones. I bring up Van Gundy, Rex Ryan, you know. I mean, some of those guys brought stuff on themselves. But think about that, because it's pretty ironic in this town that that's been the case. Even Girardi's gotten hammered and almost got fired early on in his
career. Absolutely. I'll give you two thoughts on that, Mike. One is that I think the fact that the Mets have had the narratives they've had the last 2 years have allowed people to really latch on to this notion. And I think it's right, but I can't swear to you it is, that, you know, that this guy's special talent, for better or worse, is to rescue teams from hopping into the abyss, from completely just, you know, like the Marlins have the last 2 years. I mean, you know, it's now you could also make the counter argument, well, who pushed them that close to the abyss, you know? So it's a fair question. To me, I liken it, not entirely, but to a degree, to Coughlin, in the sense that I think a lot of us try and be fair in the media. Okay. And I don't think everybody adheres to this rule, but another rule that I try and adhere to is you get one shot to fire a guy. And so you better make it count. And I do that because I think it's too easy to just say, well, we've lost, you know, football teams lost 3 in our fire, you know. I think you get one shot to fire a guy, and after that you can't fire him. Now that's there are some other guys in this town who fired Tom Coughlin 2 and 3 times. I don't say this proudly. I just say it knowing it's true. I was the first guy to fire him late in the 06 season. Yep. And so not only did that force me the next year, the very next year, of course, to write a mea culpa that I was wrong, which I don't think a lot of people do either, but I think it also allowed – I do think there were other people who adhere to that. So once you fire a guy, then you've got to just kind of wait. Now, I think most of the time, most of us use that bullet when it's almost going to happen. So it's like, you know, we're not really necessarily, you know, fostering new ground here. But in Collins' case, I remember very distinctly firing him in Washington, D.C. in August of 14. I just thought it was time. I just thought that the body work was enough to where we just realized that the Mets were never going to flourish under him. And so that's when I fired my bullet. And it didn't happen. And in 15, when I was firing my bullets, they were mostly aimed at the general manager at the time. So I didn't even have to worry about, you know,
even ran away from
the manager.
You. He ran away with you with his golden retriever.
that was hysterical. But I do think I can always think, I guess, for his arc with me is that, so he was out of my line of fire and probably remains this way. I mean, they could lose 20 games in a row, and I'm going to adhere to my thing. I got my chance, and I missed. You know, when you come into King, you best not miss. Isn't that what Omar said in The Wire? And so, to me, and I do think a lot of us fired our bullets at him earlier in his tenure. And so I do think that's probably allowed him, among many media voices, to not be under the on the constant griddle. You know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. You know, I do think that, you know, it's funny. I mean, if this little two-game renaissance the Mets are on right now leads to, you know, winning, you know, 20 wins in 25 games, Cespedes is back, and all of a sudden you look up, it's August 1st, Kindergarten's back, and it's a real pennant race, then it's only going to feed into the narrative that we've written about Terry being, what you said, a survivor. What I said, being able to rescue his teams from the abyss, and if it goes the other way, and you know they wind up losing 10 out of 12, and they're out of it by July 15th, it'll be interesting to see just how completely the narrative turns.
Here's one last thought for you. Here's the world. You go back to 2010 when Collins was hired. If I told you Phil Jackson's the idiot and Collins the hero in New York media, what would you have said to them? Think about that. Right?
I would have had them take your microphone away from you, Michael, because there's no way that would have been
right.
True, right? But
there's still people that want that to happen. Hey, it's about as unlikely as you having dinner with Calipari and Sandy Alderson at the same time, right?
That would be something, you know. Pass the potatoes, please, and you wind up getting hit in the jaw.
right. Actually, probably Calipari is the one I'd watch more than Sandy. I don't know.
That's probably right.
What do you got coming up obviously at Mike Vac on Twitter, New York Post? What, anything else you got coming up you want the listeners to know about?
Well, you know, I thought yesterday I'd be having to write a couple of horse racing columns the next 3 weeks, but since there'll be no Triple Crown, I can stay away from Belmont Park, so there's that. It's going to be mostly baseball for me. You know, I mean, when the Knicks become newsy, I'll certainly write off that, but from now until the end of the summer, I mean, or until, you know, the Mets or Yankees go on an epic losing streak, it's going to be about baseball. And to me, that's the most fun time of the job, is when you're picking. It's not about picking a sport; it's picking a team, picking a subject. And because baseball is a great look, we could continue this conversation for another 3 hours if we wanted to. That's what we like to write about baseball in this town. There's always something to write about. There's always a topic, always a subject, and that's when it gets fun.
Absolutely. Hey, you've been very generous with your time on the weekend. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll do this again, Mike. All righty?
That sounds great, Mike. It's always fun to spend time with you.
And that's Mike Vaccaro, New York Post, at Mike Vac on Twitter. Very interesting stuff. A couple of final thoughts. Let's take a quick break. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check out the show all the time at MetsMorizedOnline.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media and check out the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. We'll be back with final thoughts right after this.
Hey, Mets fans, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. If you're looking for the best unbiased and independent coverage of the New York Mets, then look no further than MetsMorizedOnline.com. Mesmerized Online is the go-to place for comprehensive Mets coverage, including exclusive interviews, daily original articles, great weekly features, in-depth analysis, minor league reports, game-by-game breakdowns, and so much more. Find out why thousands of fans turn to Mesmerized Online every day to get the latest news and opinions about the Mets. Coming from an impressive staff of the most passionate fans and skilled writers ever assembled all in one place. Check it out for yourselves, Mets fans. Go to MetsmerizedOnline.com right now. That's Mets, M-E-R-I-Z-E-D, online.com, and get mesmerized today.
All right, final thoughts here. Great stuff there from Mike Vaccaro. And one real thing I wanted just to wrap up here with was Jose Reyes. And I looked it up during the break here. And Jose Reyes is a couple of things. So if you go to the Baseball Reference Play Index and find total. So basically here's what I did. I took the position of shortstop. You go and uncheck all the positions, you go to shortstop, and 75% was where I put the minimum games. So you have to play 75% of your games at shortstop. And then said, let's sort this by hits. So let's see, 2,000 hits by Reyes. Obviously, some of them have come at third base because he played third base last year. So let's put 75% of games at shortstop. So there's, keep in mind, still a ton of games at shortstop. And here are the results if you bring them up. Jose Reyes, after hitting his 2,000th hit, is in actually the top 25, or will be close to the top 25. He needs another 53 hits to hit Orlando Cabrera, and that would put him in the top 25 all-time of hits as a player who played 75% of his games at shortstop. Now, I don't think Baseball Reference gives you the breakdown of hits by position. I could be wrong. They just say, hey, Jose Reyes has 2,002 hits. He's played 75% of his games in his career at shortstop. Here's where he ranks. If you take the third base hits out, which are pretty much everything for the most part since last year, obviously that number is significantly less. But here's a guy that's jumping into territory. The next 100 hits will put him in with names like Alvin Dark, Gary Templeton, Orlando Cabrera. Orlando Cabrera quietly had a nice little career. Quietly. If you put Jose Reyes with his stolen bases, he's in the top 10. With wins above replacement, he's in the top 35. Jose Reyes quietly has had a good career. Not the career maybe everybody wanted, and I even said that with Wright, and we'll get into Wright another time. We've talked a lot today. So I don't want to get into a Baseball Reference quote-unquote orgy here, but I really thought about it during the break. So hopefully you enjoyed it. I really enjoy Mike Vaccaro's work, and I just thought that he had a couple of columns that were good for debate, and why not? Why not get into it? I mean, the only thing that would have made it better is maybe we do it next week, because next week the Mets play at 8 o'clock. They don't have a day off the day after, so I believe we're going to have an early show, probably do something in the morning, and usually because by the time you get to it, then there's a game, who the hell knows what will happen. The content could go stale, stuff like this. The Vaccaro piece could be a little bit more fresh over the course of a few days, but I digress. So we're subject to one of those ESPN games, it seems like, next Sunday. Who knows? Maybe the league will get mad. The Mets are on the 500. The Pirates haven't been playing well. And they'll pull them. I don't think that they do that stuff. It's not the NFL. It's still early, but maybe they'll pull them. But I don't think we're going to be that lucky. Anyway, I want to thank Mike Vaccaro for joining me today. Check him out on Twitter, at Mike Vac. Of course, Mike Vaccaro, the New York Post. Great stuff at the New York Post. Check out his piece about New York managers. He also had a piece about retired numbers early in the month. Great stuff. Of course, you can check me out all the time and this show at MetsMerizedOnline.com. Send me a tweet, at Mike Silva Media. Go to iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Blog Talk Radio, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire to get this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Leave me a review on iTunes. See you next week.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.